You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma-Louise Fenelon.
I became a lawyer when women were not wanted by the legal profession.
Thousands of state and federal laws discriminated on the basis of gender. She was following in the footsteps of the battle for racial equality. She wanted equal protection for women.
Men and women are persons of equal dignity, and they should count equally before the law.
Today on the podcast, I am honoured and delighted to introduce a particularly special guest and former member of 1 Crown Office Row Chambers, Mrs. Justice Philippa Whipple, who is here to talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice of the US Supreme Court. Mrs. Justice Whipple, you are very welcome.
Well, thank you, Emma. Thank you for inviting me. And please, from now, call me Philippa. It's much easier.
Philippa, would you like to set the context? Why Justice Ginsburg? Why now?
Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it seems, has become something of a celebrity in the US in recent years. She's got a blog dedicated to her called Notorious RBG, which is a play on the name of a rapper and a fellow Brooklyn resident, the Notorious B.I.G. Please don't ask me who the Notorious B.I.G. is, because I'm afraid I won't know. She's appeared as a character in Futurama. She's appeared on The Simpsons. She's been impersonated on Saturday Night Live. She's the subject of a documentary about her life, released to mark the 25th anniversary of her nomination to the US Supreme Court. It's called RBG. And a film is due to be released shortly, depicting her involvement in an early case as a civil rights lawyer. The film's called On the Basis of Sex, and it stars our very own British actor Felicity Jones in the leading part. But the thing about RGB that you really need to know is that she's 85 years old. She's still working as a justice of the US Supreme Court. She goes to the gym and she does press-ups. She's a mother and she's a grandmother. She has had an amazing life in academia and in the judiciary, and she now finds herself a popular icon in the US. The rock star justice is how people talk of her. It seems to me like RBG mania might be about to hit the UK, so it's a good time for us to have a discussion about her.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg was born in Brooklyn in 1933, and although much has been written about her role on the US Supreme Court, less is known about her early life.
Well, we know that she grew up in the Depression in the US in the mid-1930s. We also know that her early years were marked by two personal tragedies. She did have an older sister called Marilyn, who died when she was only six from meningitis. Ruth was very young at the time, and in effect she grew up as an only child. A little later in Ruth's life, her mother, Celia, died of cancer. Ruth was only 17, and it was just 2 days before she graduated from her high school in Brooklyn. And these events must have had a profound impact on her. But notwithstanding all of that, she started at Cornell in the fall of the same year in which her mother died. And in that first semester, she met her future husband, Marty Ginsburg.
And then famously, in 1956, she entered Harvard Law School and early on marked herself out as exceptional, both in terms of her intellectual ability and notoriously in relation to her punishing work ethic.
Well, indeed, there are some good stories from this period. She's often spoken of her going to Harvard Law School, and finding herself to be one of only 9 women in a class of 500. She's spoken about how she felt herself to be on display as a woman, and that she felt she had to succeed not just for herself, but so that she didn't let other women down. Her time at Harvard Law School really was extraordinary. She'd met her husband Marty Ginsburg at school in Cornell, and they'd married at the end of their time at Cornell. But by the time she enrolled at Harvard Law School a year or two later, she had a baby daughter. This is Jane, who is now an eminent law professor in her own right. Ruth's husband, Marty, was also at Harvard Law School in the year above. But soon after she arrived, he was diagnosed with testicular cancer. So we have a picture during this time of Ruth, who looked after the baby, looked after her husband, read her husband's syllabus to be able to tell him what he needed to know to progress his studies, and then she undertook her own work, which was last in the pecking order. She speaks of having routinely had only 2 hours sleep at about that time, and she's still known, even now, as someone who manages on very little sleep.
And even with this vast workload, it's really astonishing that she managed to be appointed to the Harvard Law Review, which is reserved for the top 5% of any class.
Yes, I agree, Emma. This is really impressive. History relates, she didn't graduate from Harvard Law School. She transferred for her last year, I think, to Columbia Law School, where she completed her master's, because by that stage, her husband Marty, who had not only recovered from his illness, but also had himself graduated from Harvard Law School, he had a job in New York City, and so the family relocated there. But we have to recall, she still managed to tie for first in her class when she graduated from Columbia Law School in 1959. Looking back over this period, I think you can say that there are many good lawyers in the world, but there are very few outstanding lawyers. The outstanding lawyers, to me, are the ones who can master any subject, who can see their way through complexity, and who can answer the question in a few simple sentences. She marked herself out early as one of those, one of the very few.
And I suppose what's so surprising, certainly in today's terms, is that despite coming out of Columbia Law School so superbly well qualified, unbelievably, no New York law firm would hire her as an associate.
Well, that's right, isn't it? And it is astonishing by today's standards. But so it was. So instead of working in the city, she became a judicial clerk for a judge, Judge Palmieri, who was in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. She did that for a couple of years before she took to academia. She took an academic post, which led to a professorship at Rutgers School of Law in New Jersey. In 1965, her son James was born, so there are 10 years between her two children, between James and her daughter Jane.
In the documentary RBG, there is coverage of interviews with many of the claimants whose cases Ruth Bader Ginsburg took in order to challenge gender discrimination as it related to, for example, housing allowance, survivor benefits, and jury service. And I found it fascinating to be reminded that behind many of the incremental advances in the law were those, mostly women, with ordinary lives who were denied equal treatment on account of their sex.
Well, that's right. This is an important phase in Ruth Bader Ginsburg's career. Come the 70s, she started to become involved in this work, which really marks her career apart. And that's her work for the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. This is an old and very well-established not-for-profit organisation in the US, which works to defend and preserve individual rights under the US Constitution. In 1972, she became director of and counsel to the ACLU, at the same time as holding a professorship at Columbia School of Law, where she herself had studied. But she specifically became involved in a new project set up by the ACLU, the ACLU Women's Rights Project. This marks the beginning of an important phase in her professional life. She now started to work on what became a series of big and important cases. The unifying feature of these cases is gender equality, or, as she argued in those cases, the lack of it. And you have to understand that the 1970s was the period where women's rights came to the fore in the US.
In many ways, she was a campaigning lawyer. She had a point to make and wanted change, recognition of equality for women under the US Constitution. And so she planned her campaign and took cases which would help her get to the end point bit by bit.
Yes, indeed. Her motto was step by step. One of her first cases was Moritz and the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service. This is the case which I think is the subject of the film On the Basis of Sex. It was a case brought by an unmarried man who found he was ineligible for tax benefits while caring for his mother, those benefits being payable to women only. The story is that Marty, RBG's husband, came across the case in the course of his work as a tax lawyer, and he brought it to his wife. She was doubtful to start with about taking on a tax case, but after a little consideration, she saw that it was the perfect vehicle for some of her arguments. I'm not going to tell you what the result was in case it ruins your enjoyment of the film, but you can see that the unusual feature of this case is that it was a discrimination case brought by a man who was suing for discrimination against him as a man. It's a clever move, and it's one that we see her taking subsequently in her career as a litigator. Her first US Supreme Court as a speaking appearance was in a case called Frontiero and Richardson. That happened in 1973. That was a case brought by a female officer in the Air Force who wasn't entitled to a housing allowance, which was paid to men of equivalent rank and situation.
What's striking to me is that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had so little experience, relatively, as an advocate when she appeared in this case.
Well, I agree, Emma. I was a barrister for 21 years, and it was only after I'd been doing the job as a barrister for a good few years that I started to get instructions to appear in the higher appellate courts. Things work differently in the US, but still, it's quite a challenge to find yourself in the Supreme Court on just your second case. And of course, when you're in the Supreme Court in the US, you face nine justices, all lined up. There's a good line in this case from Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She borrowed a quote from Sarah Moore Grimke, who was a 19th century abolitionist. And this is the quote.
I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks.
I like that. So after this, there were a slew of discrimination or gender bias cases that followed. We can't discuss them all, but it's very clear that she moved legal thinking on gender issues forward very substantially during those years.
And then, of course, Jimmy Carter appointed her as a judge to the US Court of Appeals for the DC Circuit in 1980, the beginning of her judicial career. And there she worked with Antonin Scalia, famously, who was a lifelong friend but held totally divergent views.
Yes, there are some wonderful stories. They really were poles apart in their approach to the law anyway. The DC Circuit Court of Appeals is highly influential. Some people say it's really the second most important court in the US, second only to the Supreme Court. So she moved from New York at that stage to DC to take up that post. The family moved down to Washington, DC together. This is where she and Antonin Scalia first worked together at that court. It's known that they had enormous respect for each other. They subsequently ended up on the Supreme Court bench together. They frequently disagreed, perhaps most memorably, in the VMI case, which we are going to talk about. They were also on different sides in Bush and Gore, where Ginsburg dissented and Scalia was in the majority for stopping the recount of electoral ballots in Florida. They both loved opera, appearing on stage in a 1994 production of Ariadne auf Naxos in Washington, D.C., and they spent, with their families, every New Year's Eve together. During this time in the D.C. Circuit Court, she garnered a reputation as a consensus builder and, in fact, as being relatively conservative. And oddly, it was her conservatism which almost came to count against her when it came to her nomination for the Supreme Court.
Much attention in the documentary RBG, understandably, is given to her nomination by Bill Clinton to the US Supreme Court in 1993.
Yes, well, you have to remember that the appointment of judges to the Supreme Court is a very different exercise in the US from how it happens here. As we've seen recently, the process in the US is highly politicized. But there are certain aspects of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's nomination to the US Supreme Court in 1993 which I find interesting. The first is that her husband, Marty Ginsburg, by now a highly successful tax attorney in New York, lobbied hard for her. I can't imagine that being considered acceptable here, even if you had a husband who thought it was a good idea. Perhaps in a system which is political, and where lobbying is accepted, it would not be thought unusual to have a spouse joining in. Anyway, it was obviously to good effect because she was nominated. The second is the dignity and calm which accompanied her Senate confirmation hearing in 1993. She gave evidence over a couple of days and was treated with absolute respect throughout. Film footage shows her speaking to a packed room of Republican and Democrat senators without interruption, even though she spoke about contentious issues such as abortion. She was in the end voted in by a majority of 96-3, and it was said of her by some Republicans that even if they didn't agree with her, they still thought she deserved a seat on the Supreme Court. The third is her opening statement at her confirmation hearing. She has a steady, purposeful delivery, and what she says is quite striking. She speaks about her husband, who she says is extraordinary for his generation in believing that a woman's work is equal to a man's.
I have had the great good fortune to share life with a partner, a man who believed at age 18, when we met, that a woman's work, whether at home or on the job, is as important as a man's.
She pays tribute to some of the brave women pioneers who have paved the way for her to be considered eligible to serve on the Supreme Court. And she talks of the role of the Supreme Court in shaping a lasting body of constitutional decisions which will last for the long term. She speaks with real gravitas.
Many will be aware that Justice Ginsburg's first major decision concerned the Virginia Military Institute, or VMI, a prestigious state-funded all-male military college in Lexington, Virginia. And this decision was obviously one that was very important for her.
Well, VMI is a case we must talk about. Many say that it is the high point of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's judicial career. She gave the majority opinion in favour of declaring VMI's acceptance of men only to be unlawful. She forced VMI to open its doors to women. So, a bit of background. VMI, as you say, is the highly prestigious military leadership training institute in Virginia in the US. Virginia sought to defend its single-sex entrance policy, but Justice Ginsburg disagreed. She maintained that equality of opportunity could only be secured by permitting women to attend. This was not on the basis that there should be any lowering of the entry standards or differentiation between men and women, but on the basis that if there were women who met the exacting entry standards, those women should be allowed to attend in order to ensure equality of opportunity at this institution, which was of unrivaled privilege and excellence. She spoke for the majority of five. There was a dissent of four, including her old friend Justice Scalia. In consequence of that decision, VMI started admitting women. In fact, in the first year of admissions, there were 30 women in a class of around 1,500 men. Can you imagine? Ruth Bader Ginsburg went back to visit VMI on the 21st anniversary of that decision, and there's wonderful footage of her being there and meeting some of the women whose lives were affected by this change.
In many ways, Justice Ginsburg's increasingly active role as the author of dissenting opinions in recent years is a reaction to the evolving complexion of the court since 1993.
Emma, that's right. Her early years, starting in 1993, tended to show her being closer to the middle ground, but in the 25 years since then, she seems to have moved more to the left and has delivered more frequently dissenting opinions. The VMI case that we've spoken about was in 1996, and she was in the majority on that occasion. But that marks one of the last times when she was in the majority. As justices have departed from the bench and have been replaced, the court has swung further to the right, and she has tended to speak for the more liberal wing. The latter part of her judicial career has been marked by her minority dissenting judgments. You can see this starting to happen in the 2007 case of Ledbetter against Goodyear. Lily Ledbetter was an employee in an Alabama tire factory belonging to Goodyear. She worked on the factory floor as the only woman doing that kind of work at that time. She found out after 19 years of working there that she'd been paid less and significantly less than her male equivalents. The US Supreme Court rejected her equal pay claim for the entirety of that period, but Ruth Bader Ginsburg dissented. She read her dissent from the bench, which is unusual and signals a degree of outrage about the majority decision. She invited Congress to consider the issue, and in fact, shortly afterwards, Congress did amend the law, and there came into existence the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Restoration Act of 2009. It was the first bill signed by President Obama.
We must mention another case, Shelby County and Holder, which is a decision from 2013. And this seems to be the case which propelled Ruth Bader Ginsburg into public consciousness and raised her profile significantly.
Yes, this was one of five dissents that she handed down from the bench in just 1 week. The Supreme Court, by majority, struck down this piece of legislation, which required states to obtain federal pre-clearance before implementing changes to their voting rights or voting laws. Without that safeguard, the concern was that states would make changes to voter rights which would discriminate against black and other minority voters. She has another great line in her dissent to the majority decision for striking down this legislation, and it goes like this. She says, "It's like throwing away your umbrella
in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet."
Her dissent is searing.
In terms of her legacy, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is now 85. If she retires from the US Supreme Court, the likelihood is that she will be replaced by a judge with significantly more right-wing views. She's hanging on in there while she can to avoid that.
Yes, well, her husband Marty died in 2010. They were married for 50 years. He wrote her a beautiful letter, which she found in his hospital room, saying that she was the only woman he'd ever loved and how proud of her he was. You have to pay tribute to the Ginsburg marriage, which really was a union of two equals. He supported her and she supported him. They were both extraordinarily successful in their professional lives, as well as having a stable and loving home life. I like the way that they showed that it could be done that way. It doesn't appear that Marty's death has stood in her way professionally. If anything, she has stepped forward since 2010 and has found a renewed voice and greater energy. She is a lesson to all of us who fear growing old. But her legacy surely will be her impact on women's rights and the progress towards equality in the US and further afield. We should come back to the way that Justice Ginsburg has talked about numbers to prove her point. She's often talked of the fact that she was one of only 9 women in a class of 500 at Harvard. She's noted that after the Supreme Court's decision in VMI, the Institute admitted 30 women into a class of 1,500. She's been asked about numbers in the Supreme Court. She's been asked what is the right number of female justices on that bench. And she's said 9. I like that.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenlon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.